This is one day ago, and you see a lot of things here. And this looks like a bunch of ragtag. You have a bunch of Russian soldiers, some on foot, some on motorcycles, some in vehicles. You don't see any tanks or anything like that. And you may think, wow, this is just evidence of Russia, just how ragtag they are. So they're really not a modern force. Folks, this is what the face of modern war looks like. If you don't have some kind of version like this, you're not going to succeed in modern warfare. You think that, well, the NATO would come and they'd be in our M1 tanks or our Challenger tanks, Leopards. We'd have the Stryker vehicles. We'd have all the armored vehicles and everything, and we'd be able to do a lot better than this. The Russians have that stuff, not had, have those kinds of vehicles. They have their versions of. They have all different categories of tanks, armored personnel carriers, etc. They have them. But there's a reason why they're not using them, not because they don't have them. They have the, for example, there's been some T-55s or older T-72s, T-64s. There's also T-80s, T-90s. They have a whole mix of different tanks, but they're not used in big armored assaults because they are vulnerable to the drone strikes. They are using those, though, because they use them basically in indirect fire or even fire support from a distance when they come up to places where the Ukraine side is dug in or where they have fortifications built, et cetera. They do it from a distance. They rarely use them. And in fact, it's been years since I've seen any video footage anyway of any kind of armored tank-on-tank kind of battles. Now it's just using armored vehicles as an armored taxi to try to get to places. But even that's going down. The reason why, let's look at some of these. That vehicle right there you just saw, that looks like some kind of vehicle they took the doors off of, that kind of van-looking thing there. They also had the doors. This one here, yeah, thanks for freezing it there, Gary. Appreciate it. You see guys just kind of hanging out in the doors, right? So guys sitting there on top of it. He's probably the drone spotter, making sure that nobody comes in, that the drone doesn't come and get them. But there's a reason why those doors are open, because there are so many of these drone shots that we've shown you from both sides of the line often show regular civilian type vehicles being hit with drones left and right. So now then they have these that they can quickly get out of. So with the guy, the spotter on the top of the vehicle, or anybody in any of the car spots a vehicle, there's probably some kind of a code word given, and just everybody immediately gets out of the vehicle, finds the closest cover they can get, so that if the vehicle gets hit with the drone, they've lost the vehicle, but they themselves are still able to fight and live another day. The motorcycles, that would seem to be also a bad one. You're like going, hang on just a second. Motorcycles, there's no armor for that. I mean, just a regular machine gun can take you out, certainly a drone. Well, here's the thing about that. There's not many direct fire engagements either, even with machine guns. That happens sometimes when you get into trench warfare, for example. But what the Russians use these for, and I think the Ukraine side to a limited degree, is they move these things to move quickly, because it's hard to get the drones' maneuverability to hit a fast-moving vehicle like that can just drive in all kinds of wild and crazy ways and gyrate and move left and right, et cetera, and be very unpredictable in how they're moving when they're going forward. So that gives them a chance to evade from these drones. Whereas if you're in a Stryker vehicle, if you're in an M1 tank, great vehicles as far as they go, but they can't maneuver quickly. They're going to drive in a straight line. I've driven some of these, and I've been in an armored unit, so I can tell you from firsthand experience, these things are not very maneuverable. They were never designed to be. They were designed to be able to absorb a lot of direct fire weapons, et cetera, and to keep the guys safe inside from what was conventional war all through World War II, Desert Storm, Operation Iraqi Freedom, et cetera, up until about 2020, when the Armenian-Azerbaijan war started to change the face of armored mechanized warfare, and this war here has taken it to yet a new level. So there's still a place for that for armored vehicles, but you see here there's a lot of other vehicles that now seem to be technologically regression, but it's how you use the technology you have. And if you have the manpower. Now, specifically in the drones, I want to play this video here from the Duran just here recently, where a guy named Scott from Calibrated talked about some of the advancements in the drone warfare and how Russia is currently on top.
The real issue is when the manpower issues start to affect the drone operators. Drone operators are what keep the lines together, and a lot of those drone operators have been pulled from other sections of the front to Pokrovsk to try to de-block this encirclement and have been destroyed, I guess you would say, for lack of a better term, by certain groups like Rubicon, which is a Russian UAV unit who actively hunts Ukrainian UAV units. And what we're now seeing is massive gaps across the front line. I had just talked about Zaporozhye, where in eastern Zaporozhye, the Russians are advancing incredibly fast, and they're out walking in the open, something we haven't seen for like the last 3 years of this war because of the constant threat of FPV drones.
See, and that's what I mentioned earlier. There have been places along the front where you see Russians, sometimes from their own drone videos that you see, where they're just moving without any care or concern. Obviously, those in that previous video that we showed you, they were moving completely without concern because of the fog. And when you have heavy fog like that, that's your one shot to really move because the drones can't see through fog very well. There are some that have the thermal imagery, or whatever, but even that has limited. I've seen how the fog can limit even thermal view finders that are very good, but for the most part, it's not. Of course, you can still hear, but if those drones can't see through the fog very well, then that's your time to move, and that's why the Russians were moving in large numbers. Otherwise, you see nearly everything you see is that Russians move, and the Ukraine side too, when they do their counterattacks, in groups of two or three. That's all that you hardly ever see anything more than that. It's very rare because you can get one drone. Maybe it takes out two or three guys and even they'll be dispersed. But if you have, you know, a platoon of guys or 15 or 20 guys, you know, one drone can take out quite a few. So nobody moves in those in the open anymore, unless you've had your drone capability to whittle away the other side. So there are entire units, probably on both sides too, but the Russians appear to be having more effectiveness of it. Units specifically designed to only take out the other side's drone units from their drone operator. So it's drone operator against drone operator. So aside from whatever's happening on the ground with the direct firefight or trying to dislodge somebody from a building or take them out of a defended position, you've also got specific and primarily trained units to take out the other side's drone operators. If you succeed with that, then the guys who are on the ground can move in the open. And if you strip away the drone coverage from a certain area by taking out their capacity to even operate the drones, then you have the opportunity to make big, bold movements forward. Then you can get back into the possibility of even having big maneuver warfare again, especially if you can do that in a large enough area. Now, so far, the Russians haven't done that, but I would imagine that they're probably proving the concept here and to make sure that they can do something on a large scale, because if they ever have any designs, and this goes for any NATO forces in the future too, even in their concept of war, if you ever have any hope of conducting classical maneuver warfare, is the type that I fought in Desert Storm, where drones didn't even exist in any numbers, you're going to have to get to a place where you can strip away the opponent's ability to launch their own drones, whether that's reconnaissance drones, the bomber drones where they drop on top, or the other kinds of, you know, the first-person view drones, etc. You're going to have to knock those out, and that means you're going to have to get the operators out. That's the primary thing. Now, the Ukraine side, because they have a manpower crunch, they have a limited number of trained drones. And when you know that it's no longer just the guys at the front, earlier in this war, the drone operators from both sides were pretty safe because they could move pretty far back and, you know, sometimes 5 to 10 to 15 kilometers away from the front, and they could get these drones to come in along the front. Well, now then both sides realize, yeah, we have longer range drones now, more battery power, they can stay aloft a lot longer, and the technology is available, especially with the fiber optic drones, which you don't have to worry about being electronic warfare, where they're now going hunting the drone operators, and there's ways to do that, and they've got ways to identify them. But the Russians specifically have an advancing, highly coordinated and effective anti-drone system, not just platforms, but a system. They are layering counter-drone technology, electronic warfare drones, small radars, and drones that go after drones themselves. They have some that are using AI technology to where, and then in fact, that video that Gary was showing you a minute ago on the fog, you may have seen that one shot where there's a drone just sitting on the street. It was just like on the road, sitting there by itself, a pretty good sized one. What the Russians have been doing, and both sides to a certain extent, let's see, he's going to show it in just a second here. I think it's off to the left. What they had done is they'll have these drones and they'll just sit there. I think that's it, just to the left of that soldier right there. They'll just sit there and wait, oftentimes in a road like this where it can be seen, but usually it's kind of in the underbrush off to the side of it. That's it right there. Thanks, Gary. What they'll do is the drone will just sit there, and it has sensors on it where it can hear any the approach of any vehicles. It can sometimes, they depending on the kind of sensors they have, it can tell if there's any movement on the road, et cetera. And then at the command, whoever's operating the thing can then launch it. So the other side doesn't even know there's a drone there. It can launch it up and then suddenly strike within literally seconds, and nobody has a chance to do anything. That's becoming more common as well. So the you have the Russian side to using these small radars, which can then also physically detect the incoming, and then they can launch their own anti-drone drones that go after the platforms and get them in the air. So if the Russian side is able to have enough qualified drone operators, anti-drone units, and then anti-drone drones to be able to strip away, you see one after the other. One takes out the operators. One takes out the drones when they're coming in. And the electronic warfare, of course, has for a while been taking them down if they're not fiber optic drones, which the Ukraine side has as well. But you see all this stuff layered together, and the Russians have been prioritizing this. And then you see that the Russians don't use a lot of armored vehicles, which is target-rich environment for any drone. You see they're using older technology, but in newer ways, in ways that keep their troops alive and allows them to move forward. And I just showed you that map, folks. They're doing this all along the entire front line. So everywhere we look, the Ukraine military is getting smaller. Their morale is going down. Even in that earlier video we showed you from the very beginning of that, where they're shouting, Slava Ukraine, or whatever it was, the victory, and above all, you didn't see any conviction on their face. And that's the guys that are on the camera, in a relative safe spot. Gary showed you this video just a few days ago of some of the prisoners, of the Ukraine prisoners that were captured in the Pokrovsk area. There's been a couple we've shown here recently, actually, and they just had this just shell-shocked look on their face. That's one of them. That's the one that Gary showed. I mean, I made mention when we showed this the first time that when I was part of the group that took and interrogated some prisoners in Desert Storm, it was identical. I mean, who cares about what their nationalities was? The shell shock look on the especially that first guy there, the one the second one here, just really, really that one, just a really hollow look from somebody who just, you can imagine just how awful they are. And they talked about how the morale was really low. There was another video that we showed maybe a week or so ago from a group that said that they had been sent in to reinforce Pokrovsk. And he said a whole battalion, there was 500 guys, and 300 had already been killed. A bunch of others had been wounded, and there was just a handful left in a building that were even alive. That's regular. That's routine. And when you're losing troops like that, when your morale is falling through the bottom like that because you can't get quality recruits, and when you lose people in that large numbers, and then the other side figures out how to go after your drone operators, and they figure out how to knock down more of your drones on top of all of these theater level strategic drones that they have, with these Garand 2s, now Garand 3s, with these Kinzhal missiles, other hypersonic missiles, these long range multiple launch rocket systems, literally just devastating all over your country. The end is coming. And I've heard it from some folks who recently who have said that they have sources that say that so far the Ukraine leadership, military and political, nobody's leaving anywhere. So that's why I say I have serious doubts about whether Ukraine is trying to fight in the Rodinska area north of Pokrovsk in order to have a passage to extricate their troops out of Mirnograd, or if they're just trying to fight in there to even put more people in the pocket to die. I don't know, because based on their behavior, it could be both. that's certainly going to lower your motivation even further if you realize that you're being sent in into to join some other guys who are already marked for death or capture. That's not going to really raise your morale much. But it looks like that the Ukraine leadership across the board has said, we're just going to keep fighting and dying in place, whether that's in Kharkiv up in the north, in Kupiansk, in Seversk, or down in Pokrovsk, or in Zaporizhia area. Opposite Kherson, there's some fighting going on down there. I didn't mention earlier, everywhere you look, the Russians are advancing. Nowhere is there any possibility that on even a portion of the front, is there an option for Ukraine to start moving the front backwards. It just simply doesn't exist. And if it doesn't exist, then where is the morality that says we're going to keep fighting? We're going to keep going. You can't reverse here. Sanctions, they don't have any impact. The more weapons that you're claiming you're going to get from the Europeans, from being sold from the United States, air defense missiles, all those do is slow down the air attack some. Not that much, as you see, because no matter how many air defense weapons you have, the Russians will be able to saturate it with more platforms in the air. And whatever you take out, there's always more on the Russian side that's going to go in. And those images Gary's showing you right there will just become a regular daily occurrence. And now then, as we're really getting into the cold weather system and as season, it's just going to be really, really hard for the people to even live. That's, of course, if the people are suffering, you can only imagine how much the troops on the front line are suffering as well. And at some point, just the mathematics and just human nature is going to kick in. And I think that in the new year, as we get through the maybe even into before we even get out of the winter of 2026, I think the chances of you seeing large sections of the front collapsing are going to increase. Now, I suggested there was a chance they could have collapsed last summer. They didn't. They made it another whole year. But the fundamentals that led me to believe that was possible then were accurate, because it was. But the courage and the tenacity of the Ukraine side and their just absolute unwillingness to acknowledge reality, they kept fighting anyway. So they didn't fall. Don't gain any confidence from that. It's not like, well, they held on then so they can hold on forever, because in the year since they didn't collapse in the summer of 2024, there have probably been hundreds of thousands of men who died. Not just wounded, that's probably hundreds of thousands more. But there's hundreds of thousands died, and there just aren't more. We showed you a graphic here just in the last couple of months. 100,000 men age 18 to 22 have fled the country. The desertions are just off the charts. The casualties themselves are off the charts. And there just aren't people enough that are still in the men that are still in the country. There just aren't enough of them to come in. And the reason why you keep seeing all of those videos of people being beaten on the streets, thrown into vans and put into transportation to get to the front is because they know it's nearly a death sentence. And it is. That's how it's working out. And you can't grab people off the streets like that and ever think that you're going to turn the tide when you see the Russian sides are moving forward and their morale is through the roof. And we've seen that, and it makes sense. It's understandable. That's the reason they're still able. Yeah, they pay a lot of money for bonuses, but don't gain any confidence from that either, because the guys do come in. The money is enough because they like, I want to be part of this. I want to be a part of something that's winning. And they don't think it's a death sentence, or they wouldn't volunteer. So they're still volunteering for this at numbers that allow them to not have to do any forced mobilizations. Everything is moving in the direction where this cannot succeed. Yeah, that's routine right there. It's incredible. And that tells you everything you need to know. Folks, there are no fundamentals other than just these wishful thinking by Volodymyr Zelensky I showed you at the beginning, or Keir Starmer, or Merz, or Duda out of Poland, literally everyone, Macron, Mark Rutte from NATO, Ursula von der Leyen, Kaya Kallas. So all these big speeches these folks always made and all these thunderous applause they get when they speak in different parliaments, none of those folks have to face all this stuff I've just showed you here, all these videos that Gary has shown you here today. That is the reality. That's what's going on the front. And that is where this war will be lost. Not in the thunderous applause and the statements that are detached from reality that they're making on a daily basis. And there will have to be a reckoning for this, because it's just inevitable that it's going to come. There are no fundamentals that exist that this can be even stopped, much less even reversed. That's not even possible. And we'll just have to track this and we'll keep you appraised as it goes on. But it's just something that is going to be egregious that historians will look back on, and populations will say, how could you guys have been so careless, so gutless, and so callous to the human suffering of your side? And I guess the answer is going to be ignorance. It's going to be greed. It's going to be we just don't value human life. Whatever words come out of our mouth, I don't know, some combination of all that. But whatever, they're going to have to figure this out. And all those people by name I just mentioned, I'm telling you right now, history will not be kind to any of them. And they will be shamed and humiliated. Can't come soon enough. And anything that keeps this war going on is a shame in and of itself. And I would love to see that end, because I genuinely care a lot about the men that are suffering in Ukraine, about the civilian population that's suffering in Ukraine, only because we are keeping the war going. Yes, I got it. It's the Russians that are firing the bombs and the missiles and the drones, and they're the ones that are pulling the triggers, and that's killing a lot of Ukrainians. That's a fact. This is a war, and that's just how it works in the war. Once you've started it, you've got to be able to finish it, either through negotiations or from winning it. And if the side is going to be able to win it, that's the ugliness of war. That's why I detest and despise war, because once it gets started, there's no going back, and unless you're going to do the rational, logical thing and see that you can't win it and end it so that no more people die. Otherwise, you're going to have what the Russians are doing. You can hate the Russians all day long for what they're doing, and I get it, but they have the power. As is throughout the history of mankind, anyone who's got the power pushes it on until they get what they want and they succeed on the battlefield. And we can dislike that, we can hate it, but as long as we keep ignoring it, more men are going to die. That's where we are, folks. We're going to continue to bring this stuff as it breaks and happens. Also, man, do we have a great one for you this afternoon. We've been getting people, been asking for a long time to find the MIT professor Ted Postol to come and tell us what in the world is going on with this Russian doomsday weapon, whether it's with the Poseidon, the one that goes underwater, the nuclear propulsion system there, or the Burevestnik, the new cruise missile that has the nuclear warhead capability and a nuclear propulsion system. We kind of finally got Ted Postol back with us today. 2 o'clock, he's going to give us his bottom line about what's going on. And then at 3:30, you may have seen that there was a vote in the Senate last night to end the government shutdown in the United States. We're going to tell you what that means and what still has to happen in the House of Representatives. It could come as early as tomorrow, but there are some caveats with that too. Join us for that at 3:30 today, and we will see you then on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive.